very first broadcast of Gangland Wire Crime Stories. We're sitting here in Studio 4. That's the studio for the Big Dumb Fun Show. My friend, producer, and co-host, Aaron Gnerk, is here. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron. To hear local music and keep up on the local music and film scene, visit BigDumbFunShow.com. Tune in. We're live Monday, 7 to 10 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks, Aaron.
But enough about that. What about Gangland Wire Crime Stories?
Yeah, what about Gangland Wire Crime Stories? Well, you don't know me yet. Some of you do. My name is Gary Jenkins. I am an ex-cop, a lawyer, filmmaker, an app developer, and now a podcaster. If you want to find more about me, just Google ganglandwire.com and you'll find more than you ever wanted to know. You know, when I say ex-cop, I always think back to that bit that Aykroyd and Belushi did called Ex-Police. I remember the very first one I saw. They went to an apartment, they knocked on the door, and a guy came to the door, and they let him in, and they held out these empty badge cases, and because they were ex-police. They'd had their badges taken away, and they found some little bag of marijuana, and they picked him up and threw him out the window, and Aykroyd walks over the window and looks down, and he says, "Well, it looks like another drug-related homicide." Belushi looks back up at him. He says, "You know, let's roll, partner. Our business is done here." As some of you may know, if you know me, I spent 12 years as a Kansas City police officer investigating organized crime. I was assigned to the Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit. During those years, I was involved with a number of interesting investigations, and I'm going to relate some of those. And for my first show, or my first series of shows, I think it's going to be a 5-episode series, I'm going to tell a little-known story about the gang that could not detonate a bomb. First, I need to set the scene. Now, in the early 1970s, the Kansas City branch of the La Cosa Nostra family was ruled by a boss named Nick Civella. As with any mob family, there was a chain of command. Nick's main confidant and advisor, some call this position the consigliere, and that was his brother, Carl Cork Civella. Now, they called him Cork Civella because he had a hot temper and he would pop like a cork. Now, any mob family always has an underboss, and the underboss is the guy that takes care of day-to-day business on the street, and the underboss insulates the main boss, or in this case, Nick Civella, from mob associates or other non-made members and anybody else deemed not trustworthy that they do business with. If in this case, the underboss was a man named Carl Tuffy DeLuna. Everybody on the street knew the name Tuffy, and I think that moniker meant no more than that. He was tough, and he always had been tough.
Now, this was the 1970s.
Correct.
When you started on the force, but these people had been in Kansas City for a number of years before that.
Correct. They really started at the turn of the century, and they called it the Black Hand when the newly arrived Italian immigrants arrived here. They formed up a criminal gang, and they called it the Black Hand Gang, and that was because they would go solicit money, shall we say, a street tax, extort money from other newly arrived immigrant shopkeepers. And if they wouldn't pay up, they would send them a note with a threat on it, and they would put a black hand on it, and so they became known as the Black Hand. As a matter of fact, our current-day boss, Nick Civella, when he was a young man coming up in the 20s, he was born in probably 1912, 1910, and so by 1925, he was 15, 16 years old, 1930, and he was the leader of a little street gang, and he did not like the old Black Handers. The old Black Handers had actually victimized his father. Mm-hmm. His father had a store, and he did not like them, but he was going to be a criminal, because if you think about it, newly arrived Italian immigrants, they didn't speak the language, or they had a funny accent, they looked different, they dressed different, and they were really kept out of the mainstream of business and
kind of ostracized in the community.
Ostracized in the community from the mainstream, and so primarily, see, the Irish were already here, and they were pretty well set up with jobs in the city government, with police jobs and construction jobs and things like that. And Italians were squeezed out from that. And so many times, if you've got young, intelligent, bright men, and they're squeezed out from the normal occupations, then they're either going to start some kind of a little, in this case, produce business, or maybe a restaurant. something that you could do yourself with your family, or they would go into criminal endeavors. And that's what happened. They went into criminal endeavors. And of course, Prohibition came along, and they were poised to make a lot of money in Prohibition because they're already set up in the criminal gangs. But Nick Civella had his own little gang, and he was robbing protected gambling games. They were protected by the O-Line Mustache Pete's or the Black Handers, and he and his gang were going around robbing them.
Like back room?
Back room, yeah. Like
back room gambling?
You would have a bar, and then gambling's illegal in Kansas City.
Yeah.
So you would have a couple tables set up for card rooms or dice tables in the back. Or maybe it would be a horse racing parlor. They had horse racing, had wires leading in. They called it the wire room. Where
so they could
would
keep track of what the returns were on the races.
On the horse races, correct. And so
now, how could Nick Civella shake these guys down if they're already protected by the Black Handers?
Well, he didn't shake them down. He went around and robbed them at gunpoint.
Oh.
and that's actually the way these young guys, they go around and rob other criminals as their kind of entrance into the criminal behavior. Only the baddest of criminals rob other criminals. And he was the baddest of the young guys at the time, and he robbed other criminals. So that was his entree, and he actually had to leave town and went to Chicago. They killed a friend of his, and so he left town and went to Chicago and laid low for a while.
Did his brother Cork, was he involved?
You know, that's interesting. That's a good question. Cork is not really mentioned in any of the documents that I could find during this time. He had to be involved with that, but he laid low, and he did not become a target. He didn't run off to Chicago. Nick had to run to Chicago after they tried to kill him, and they killed a guy named Buggy Anch, who was his main guy robbing these games. But, you know, it might have been Cork was younger. See, he might have still been a teenager, and maybe he didn't really include him in on it, but he was not involved until later on.
And Tuffy DeLuna?
Tuffy was even much younger, so Tuffy was probably like a young teenager, and he was not involved with that early stuff. He didn't come along maybe. A little bit later.
But Nick Civella, he goes off to Chicago.
Yeah, he goes to Chicago, and then lays low. He comes back. All isn't forgiven. They try to kill him again down about Truman Road, and there was a liquor store, Trucker's Liquor Store, about Truman Road and Paseo. He's sitting in it's a really interesting story. He's sitting in a car. His car, and he meets a Jackson County deputy sheriff named Louis Cuccia. And I imagine Deputy Cuccia was a little bit on the wrong side, more than likely, because he gets into Nick Civella's car, but he gets in the driver's seat, and Nick slides over into the passenger seat. Well, somebody has seen Nick there, and they still want him, and while they're sitting there, a car pulls into the parking lot. They jump out. I think one had a machine gun and one had a shotgun, and they just start shooting that car up, and they shoot at the driver's side. They kill the deputy sheriff, Cuccia. Nick Civella rolls out, and he's on the lam to Chicago again. And some deal is brokered, and you know, you don't really ever know all the details of these kinds of things, the ins and outs. And
but somehow he was able to come back to Kansas City.
When he came back, he was okay because he soon became the driver for a man named Tony Gizzo, who was the boss at the time. And so that marked the ascension of Nick Civella when he came back and became the driver for Tony Gizzo, because within about 2 years Tony Gizzo dies, and guess who becomes the new mob boss?
Nick Civella.
1952 or 53, he is the mob boss. As a matter of fact, by 1957, there's a famous mob convention in upstate New York, and it's well known. If you're a mob aficionado or mob historian, mm-hmm. you know about the Appalachian Convention in 1957. And mob bosses from Chicago, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Kansas City, all the five families in New York City, and Boston.
All meet in the Appalachians?
All meet at this this one guy, his man's name was Barbosa, and I can't remember his first name. He is a mobster out of Philadelphia, I believe, and he has got a farm and a large, almost like a mansion up in upstate New York, and the name of the town, the closest town, was Appalachian. And all these mob guys show up out in the country. It's a rural area. And it looks kind of funny.
Sure it would.
And the local state trooper, he thinks it looks really funny. And so he calls in a bunch of his buddies, and they just raid the farmhouse. They just drive up and get out and knock on the door. And as they're driving up, people are bailing out and getting in their cars trying to leave, and they're running out through the woods. And they capture up everybody they could, and that's how we know that the bosses from those all these families are there. And Nick Savella.
But they all are released eventually. They didn't spend time.
They had to just release.
They just busted up the meeting.
Right. They just identified them. It was a great piece of intelligence for law enforcement, because that was the first time we really knew that they were all coordinating with each other across the whole United States. All these different cities knew each other, and they were coordinating. And
Nick Savella, he was there.
He was there. It came out later that there was a man named Tano Lococo, who was about 10 years Nick's senior, and had been kind of a previous mob upper echelon guy, but never really was a boss. He was there with Nick, and then eventually it came out that he was there to introduce Nick Savella in 1957 as the boss of Kansas City. And so that's the date we know that he had been the boss for a while, but we know for sure
that he's now officially
the boss in 1957,
as recognized by all the other families.
Right, and that's important to be recognized by the other families, because at this point in time, you know, we're much more mobile, and we've got telephones, and we communicate. Post-war, a lot of stuff going on. Connection there. He had his own hooks into the Teamsters Union in Kansas City, and Chicago had their hooks in the Teamsters Union in Chicago. Cleveland had their hooks in Cleveland. Milwaukee had their hooks in Cleveland, and they all are going to work together, and that becomes more important later on. But not really for this story.
We haven't even gotten to the story. We're almost 9 minutes of just setting up the fact that here's Nick Savella.
Here's Nick Savella,
and here you are, an intelligence unit officer.
Right.
Thrown in the middle of a story that's really already going on.
It's been going on since the turn of the century, basically.
Yeah.
And they're pretty well ensconced. This was the peak of their financial power, I would say, in the 1970s, because of the Teamsters Union connection and because of the connection to Las Vegas casinos. They were getting a lot of money out of the casinos. But let's go on with this story. During this time, in the late 60s, or I think it was 1970 maybe, I came on the police department in 71, and I think Nick was already killed.
Nick Spiro.
There's a set of brothers. Their last name is Spiro, S-P-E-R-O. And the oldest brother is Nick. And he is what we call a mob associate. He wasn't a made guy. But he was connected to the mob, and if you're an associate, if you know Henry Hill, or if you know Goodfellas, those guys, Jimmy the Gent, and those guys were all mob associates. They were professional criminals, but they were protected by the mob. Well, Nick Spiro was a professional criminal, and he was protected by the local mob. But what that meant, if he did any crime and made money, then he had to give Nick Savella a little piece of the action. They call it wet their beak, you know, let me wet my beak in this.
Yeah.
They have to give him a little piece of the action. In return, they get some political protection. They get some protection if they end up in court, if they end up in jail, if protection from other criminals.
Because there were other people that were probably trying to move up in the crime scene.
Right. And Nick is trying to move up. Well, that was Nick's downfall. Nick Spiro was trying to move up. I get all these Nicks. There's Nick Savella, who's the boss, and there's Nick Spiro, who is the upstart or the young Turk. And he's trying to move up. And he also is creating a lot of disruption. They're kind of staid. And Nick Spiro was dressing, this was the 70s, Nick Spiro was wearing loud clothes, bell-bottom pants, let his hair grow out long, and he was loud and brash and anyhow and kind of obnoxious, and they got him a good job at Yellow Freight with the Teamsters Union, and a kind of a no-show job, and also put him in with truck driving people so he could set up loads to be ripped off out on the highway, get that inside information, and he also had some action going. He had some narcotics connection up in, it was another state, I think it was Iowa, and he wasn't supposed to deal in narcotics anyhow. That was part of the Appalachian deal, was we don't mess with narcotics because there's too many flaky people involved, and there's too draconian a sentences, and it makes people into snitches. And also, the public do not like narcotics, and it dirties us up too much, and we need our political contacts. We need to be able to make political donations to judges and make political donations to city council members.
And it's all right to rob a yellow freight.
Right,
but
right,
it's not okay to sell some smack on the street.
Yeah, correct. That's true. And
Nick Spiro was.
And that's true today. I mean, how many people have you ever known that bought something that fell off the back of the truck and everybody laughs because it was taken from somebody's truck?
It didn't actually fall.
Right. Those little corruptions, a lot of people in this city have bought records from Tiger's Records for a half price. They were all shoplifted records. I mean, we all have our little corruptions, but narcotics, being dabbling in narcotics is too much corruption.
Mm-hmm.
So
Nick Spiro, although he was an associate, was not a made member.
No, he was not a made guy. He would not have been doing those narcotics if he'd been a made guy. But he was too loud and brash and too ambitious to ever be a made guy anyhow. Nick was killed, and it was a typical mob killing. Several shots to the head, stick him in his trunk of his car, and leave him in a side street up north of the river. That just has, you know, mob killing all over it, and then you find out about his connections and his history. He's killed by the mob.
Now, when they found the car just was in a vacant lot?
Yeah, it was just on the side street.
Side street, just
left
sitting there?
Like 4 o'clock in the morning, just sitting
and
there.
No one heard any shots?
No.
No one saw the
no.
car get pulled
no.
up there?
Now, they probably
they
usually
wiped it clean of fingerprints.
Yeah, they probably were careful about fingerprints. And this is long before DNA and modern criminal techniques of gathering evidence. And probably what they did is they got a couple of guys in the car that he trusted with him, and one of them probably got in the back seat, or it might have been on just the passenger, and killed him right there in the car. That becomes a crime scene. And then just stick him in the trunk and leave it there and walk away, throw away the gun, throw away your clothes. If nobody saw it and you don't tell anybody,
nobody knows.
Nobody knows. It's a perfect murder, and they've done a lot of them like that. You know, the deal is you get a friend to go set the guy up in the mob. That's it. That's the way they got somebody that was close to him.
Hey, we're going
to
meet. Let's meet here.
Right.
One guy, instead of one guy showing up, two guys show up.
Correct. What's he doing here? Oh, I need him along for whatever reason. And he gets in the back seat, for example.
Yeah. And a normal car wouldn't be that unusual.
Right. Right. And it contains the crime. It contains the crime scene. They control the setting.
Mm-hmm.
They get him to go someplace, and you've seen it in movies. They say, hey, pull over here. I got to take a leak. And so they pull over in an alley or someplace that's out of the public view, and they kill him and stick him in the trunk and leave him up there. So his brother, Carl Spiro, who's the youngest brother of the four brothers, there was four brothers, Mike Spiro, Joe Spiro, Carl, and Nick. Nick's dead. Mike is working on the docks at Yellow Freight. Joe's working on the docks, I think, someplace else. They both have Teamster's job. Carl Spiro is more of an out-and-out criminal. He's in prison right now for being part of a large jewelry theft. He was a jewel thief. They would go out and burglarize high-end jewelry stores. And he was in jail over in Kansas when his older brother was killed. So he gets out of prison. About 1975, he gets out of prison, and Carl comes back with a plan. He wants to form his own organization, and he wants to challenge the Savella faction for domination, and he also wants revenge for his oldest brother Nick's death. Carl ends up in a used car lot about Gregory and Troost out there as kind of a place to meet, and he needs a guy, a really, really tough guy. And I had an informant at the time who was able to, working at that car lot, and he was able to go into a back room and listen through a thin wall into the office, and he heard him talking about, we want to get the Arab. We'll get the Arab. When are we going to get the Arab? When's the Arab going to get? We got to get the Arab here. And he knew Carl was planning something, but he couldn't really, you know, just bits and pieces. And I didn't know who the Arab was.
Well,
at the
Carl
time.
Had just shown up because he had just gotten out of prison.
Right, right.
So, and then he gathers his other brothers here with him.
Yeah.
But, right. And they're in the back of a car lot in some room. How How do you even find out that they were meeting there?
Well,
I mean, this guy, your informant.
Because we're the police. That's how we find out.
You actually were like following Carl after he got out of prison, realizing that.
Yeah, not exactly. We at the time that car lot had another mob guy and was owned by a mob associate. So
they were all still meeting there regularly anyway.
It was on our radar anyhow. and so you just go by. This is how it works, Aaron. You know there are different spots that they own businesses or mm-hmm. where they drink.
You know
or
the businesses they own because they use their real name.
Right, or one of their associates, you know. Yeah. This guy was named Joe Sibliano, and he actually was kind of a low echelon guy that we didn't even know before. And he had this car lot, and we hear about this guy, Joe's got a car lot, and Jimmy Duarte might show up, who's another mob guy. So you just drive by every once in a while, you write down license numbers, and you go back, and or maybe you sit across the street, and you say, well, who's there? And then you get those license numbers, and you just file them and put them in a report, and pretty soon you got a pattern about who's there. And so in this case, this guy...
Carl Sparrow?
Carl Sparrow has shown up, this guy who ends up becoming my informant, he has gone somewhere else, and I can't remember. I just walked up to him. He's working somewhere else. I said, hey, you used to work over there at, what was it? Not Affordable Motors, but something like that. Yeah, nobody would remember it. It was long gone. But say, AA Motors, double A Motors or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I said, you used to work over there. And he just looks at me like, oh, my God, you got me. And so I pressed him a little bit, and he starts telling me.
Well, when you were in the intelligence unit, were you plain clothes?
Plain clothes, yeah.
So you just walked up to him like a guy on the street.
Well, I mean, he knew I was a cop. I identified myself as a cop. Okay. I didn't try to undercover him. That would not have worked with this guy. He was too tough and too canny for that. But he had a secret. And I didn't know he had a secret, but he had a secret. And that secret was he had once helped Carl Sparrow with a stolen bulldozer. And he thought I knew. And I didn't know that. I had no idea until much later on, he told me about this. But so he starts telling me, who's hanging out there, and these guys are meeting, his Arab's out. And he starts telling me that Arab's working for this meat company. And I said, well, who is this guy? He said, I don't know. His name was... Krigo or Grego or something like that. And
so this guy, Leonard Krigo, who's known as the Arab on the street?
He's known as the Arab on the street. We just keep poking at this. And finally, I talked to some other people. I found out about a guy who was what we call a peckerwood, a non-Italian guy. And we find out that Carl Sparrow
is that a police term or is that
no? That's an Italian term. That's what Italians in this city call non-Italians. At least some, not all Italians, but a lot of Italians call non-Italians peckerwoods. You're peckerwood, and it's like I think if you're black, you're a fungi, and I think that's mushroom for mushroom. And I'm trying to think if there's another term. I don't know what they call Jewish people, but
or
probably
Arab
just
people.
The only thing I've heard is a Jew, but. Anyhow, we're peckerwoods. So I talked to this peckerwood who had a basement company, and he thought I knew more than I did, too, and he had some secrets. And so I got him to open up about Carl Sparrow just on the side, off the cuff a little bit. He was just trying to get me to like him and not really look into him very much. And he said that Carl had approached him. And later on, I found out why he was so scared. He was getting into cocaine, and he was starting to deal cocaine. He ends up getting killed in a cocaine deal a few years later.
Krigo did.
No, this Jim Farron that I'm talking to. I'm trying to find out who Krigo is.
Okay.
And I know I'm kind of skipping around a little bit here, and sometimes it's hard to tell in a linear form. But he tells me who Krigo is, and he tells me that Carl Sparrow has asked him to join his gang. It's almost like our gang. You know, hey, we've got a club. We're going to meet at this joint that I'm going to buy over on the 103rd and State Line, and we'll meet in the back room, and we're going to take over all the gambling and stolen property interests from the Savellas. We're going to push them out, and we're going to be in control. And so he gives me the whole name, Leonard Leonard Crego, C-R-E-G-O, and he was known as the Arab on the street. And so by then, I go down to Jefferson City, or I call down there, and I find out about him. He's been down there for armed robbery.
Pulled his record.
Pulled his record. And I also find out from a guard down there that he was the most feared inmate in the prison at Jefferson City, the state penitentiary down there. He controlled all the traffic practically in contraband and all the weaker inmates that were used for prostitution. He controlled all that. And they told a story about how some of the black inmates, they always, you have like in prisons, they're always broken down by racial lines. So today you had the Aryan Brotherhood. Back then you just had the white guys and the black guys, I think. Now you got the Mexican Mafia and Costa Rican, or not, it's not Costa, what's that one?
Dominican?
Honduran, I think. Anyhow, you got them broken down by ethnicity primarily. And back then, I think it was just white guys and black guys. And so several black inmates caught Crego by himself, but he had a spear he'd made with a shank and a broomstick, and he fought them all off and maintained his dominance over even the black gangs down there. But and what I'm my point is, this is one bad dude that Carl Sparrow's got out to do his bidding. So he's setting his plan in action, and the Savella faction is kind of aware of this on the street. And Nick Savella is probably one of the most Machiavellian mob bosses ever, I think. He knows he wants to head Carl Sparrow off, and he doesn't really know about that Carl's trying to build a whole gang to take over their action. He thinks that he's just mad over them killing his older brother, Nick. So his plan is, there's a guy named Glenn Curly Mitz, who's a professional criminal who had done business and committed crimes with Nick Sparrow. And he's killed during this time. And probably the Savellas set him up to be killed for who knows what reason. They set him up to be killed, and then they start putting out the word that they had...
They set up and killed who?
This guy named Curly Mitz.
Curly Mitz.
Curly Mitz.
Who was working for them.
He was a professional criminal in and around. He was not particularly working for anybody. He was his own guy, but he had done crime with Nick Sparrow.
And they knew that.
And they knew that. And so it was easy then to have him killed and then go around and say, you know, he killed Nick Sparrow and we had him killed.
Yeah.
Trying to mollify
whether
Carl.
That was true or not.
Yeah, right. And it sounded true because Curly Mitz had done crime with Nick. And it was easy to assume that they had a falling out. That would be a normal thing, a take that you would have if you knew Curly Mitz and Nick Sparrow had done crime together, and then you suspected Nick or Curly Mitz of killing Nick Sparrow. It would be a normal thing to think, yeah, he would be a likely suspect because they had done crime together and they had some kind of falling out. This happens all the time. Mm-hmm. One of them takes more of the money, or one of them is nervous.
They have a dispute,
or they have some kind of dispute. It happens all the time. But I don't think Carl Sparrow ever bought that story. But the Nick Savella had that put out, and that was quite a plot to try to mollify, shall we say, or push Carl Sparrow out of being angry at him and put the blame on this guy named Curly Mitz.
Yeah, who's now dead.
Who's now dead, yeah. Life is a little bit cheap in that subculture, you know, and if you hadn't realized. Now,
but Carl Sparrow, he did not necessarily believe this, he still had his own plans to take things over.
He had his own plan. It was already going. It was much more than revenge on his brother. Now, the first blow we know that was struck by Carl at Nick Savella and Savella faction was a robbery of a man named Al Brandemeyer. Nick Savella was partners with Al Brandemeyer in what was the BNC Meat Company, or the Brandemeyer and Savella Meat Company. It was just a small meat company, and they'd get insides of beef and cut it up and sell it out to restaurants and to the public, and it was over here on the east side. But it was also a front for a sports book operation for the Savellas, and Al Brandemeyer was a bookie, and really the main source of income outside of a casino scam, which was really just getting formed up to get started right then, was sportsbook. There was a huge amount of money going down on the Chiefs and all the, especially the NFL, and the mob controlled all that in Kansas City. They controlled it all in Chicago and Cleveland and all the major cities. They controlled the
different mob families.
Different mob families.
Yeah, but here in Kansas City,
the Savella controlled the sportsbook. You did not make book without somehow being in business with the Civella family.
But did they do book out of the back of B&C Meats?
Well, you don't really have to do book out of back anywhere. You, as long as you got a telephone and people can contact you. He might have been there. He might have gone to a bar and seen some of his people. And Al Brandemeyer was like the next step up. He probably didn't go out and deal with individual bettors. He probably just dealt with
bankrolled
the other bookies and held the money and paid off and looked at the books. And if they were out of balance, they would try to lay off to Chicago or to another city. Mm-hmm. You see, a mob does not gamble. When they run a sports booking operation, they don't gamble.
They take money either way.
They take it on both sides, and they try to keep it equal on both sides, and they take 10%, what they call VIG, from the loser. And that's their money. And so a guy like this, you know, he was kind of, he would deal with the bookies, and he would insulate Nick Civella or Corky or Tuffy from these bookies, because these bookies were not made guys, and bookies could be turned. Bookies can rat you out. Bookies are likely to do that because they are not the toughest guys in the world. They're bookies.
Well, they may have a gambling problem of their
own.
They
may have their gambling problem of their own, but mainly they're, yeah, and many of them do. I got the trash from a bookie once, a Kansas City bookie, and I figured out from all his old betting slips, I was able to decipher them, and he had lost about, like, I don't know, and he wasn't a rich guy. He'd lost $5,000, $6,000 just in the last 2 weeks. So I approached
him. Just on his own.
Just on his own. And I approached him, and I told him, and he's like, oh, my God. And you know, it was about a month later. I was trying to turn him as a source, and he was really considering it. And about a month later, he lived not too far from me, and I ran into him at the grocery store. I had my kids with me, I think. And, hey, how you doing, Pat? Hey, I'm doing okay. And he said, you know, I know what you did. I said, what do you mean? He said, you got my trash. You went through my trash, didn't you? I said, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about, but that's what I'd done. I got all his booking betting slips out of his trash.
And he figured it out.
He figured it out. So anyhow, he never really worked out, and I didn't have enough to really charge him with anything anyhow. So that's just a little side story. But anyhow, this first blow struck by Carl Spiro and Nick Civella, he sends the Arab over to rob Al Brandemeyer. So Al Brandemeyer has about $10,000 in cash one evening, and a guy walks in with two guns, and he holds him up. He takes the money. Brandemeyer has a Cadillac that's sitting in the parking lot of the B&C Meat Company, and it's evening. It's like 5 o'clock or so, and not many people around. And it may have even been, it was dark out, I believe. He puts him in the trunk of the car, and he sends a message. And this is written in the police report. I read it. He said Al Brandemeyer gets in the car, and the spare tire is just laying out, and he is already smart enough. For some reason, he crawls in behind it. And this guy out standing outside with two guns starts firing both guns into the trunk and saying, you tell that fucking Nick Civella that the Arab is back in town. And Al Brandemeyer lives. He's not even hit. He's gotten behind the spare tire, and he's not even hit.
Maybe he's familiar with the whole putting someone in the trunk thing.
I think that might have been a surprise, but he probably got pretty nervous when a guy like the Arab put him in the trunk.
I don't know how big Al Brandemeyer is, but how do you fit behind just a single spare?
Well, I don't know. It's a Cadillac. It was a 70s Cadillac. Those were big cars.
Man.
And if you ever saw Leonard Crago, you would know he was scared. That guy, I interviewed that guy in jail, and he had eyes that were just dead. They just looked right through you, right through you. It was like you were, if he wanted to just crush you and crush the life out of you, he was physically big enough and strong enough to do it, and he wouldn't care.
Leonard Crago?
Yeah. He was bad. Oh. They tried to get me to go back down to the penitentiary and interview him after he went down, and I wouldn't do it. That was another guy does.
Now,
no,
what did he go back to the pen for?
Well, we haven't got to that story yet. But let me commit to it. Let me finish this story here, and then I'll get to him going back.
So you were actually at the scene at B&C Meat?
No,
there?
I didn't even know it happened until, like, you know, probably a week later. We weren't like, you know, you're not like right on these guys all the time, and this happens, and nobody knows. You know, nobody really knows. Street policeman comes out, takes a report, writes all this down, files it, goes down to the detectives. They look at it and say, I wonder who this was, and throw it in the pile. Because there's, you know, they don't
there's
know who
so many
this
reports.
Is. Yeah, so many reports, and they don't have any idea who the Arab is. Now, today, there's a lot more sophisticated, and they might look through the moniker file and all that, and they might find some. But in 75...
But at the time, it's just paper reports just and another, files
yeah,
and
right.
folders. And
right, and they knew enough to know that Brandon Meyer was a bookie, and he was a criminal, too. And so it's not high on their priority. It's high on
well,
intelligence
it was B&C
priority.
Meets.
B&C meets with Brandon Meyer and Savella.
Yeah, so wouldn't you...
They knew that. They knew he was a bookie. They knew it was a mob deal.
Yeah.
But they didn't care.
They didn't care?
They got murders.
I mean,
murders.
Are you talking about the street police?
The street police don't
know. They take the report.
They don't even know.
Like when the call comes in...
They don't know. And they probably didn't even mention the name Savella. He just said the B&C meat company anyhow. And the detectives probably kind of knew... But it was just another mob deal and was not going to be solved. They never solve a mob crime, and so they just go on.
But so Leonard Crago takes $10,000 from him?
Right, $10,000. And by then, on the street, they know who the Arab is, and it didn't take them long. The Savellas to figure out that he's connected up to Carl Spiro. And not only at about the same time, there's a Spiro associate named Johnny Brocato, and he's kidnapped and tortured. And when they find him, the contents of his stomach are still frozen. So I believe he was kept in a meat locker, and that was probably a message. And the mob, when they commit a murder, they often leave a message, you know, like the Nick Spiro being in the trunk of his car, shot in the head up north of the river. That's kind of a message, you know, hey, this is an execution. And so...
When they find a tortured body and
tortured
it's frozen.
Tortured body with frozen contents of the stomach, and somebody calls his relatives.
Nobody looked at B&C Meats because they do have some meat lockers there.
Right, right. But again, it was, there weren't the forensics that we have today. So even if it was committed, if the murder was committed down there, they didn't have that luminol to spray around and see if there was blood. And they didn't have the ability to get little flecks of, you know, microscopic flecks and go, you know,
whose DNA it is.
Whose DNA, see if Johnny Brocato was hanging on a meat hook down there. And anyhow.
Well, but did... Do you think they got any information out of Johnny Brocato?
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. They probably got the whole story out of Johnny Brocato and that Carl's putting these guys together and he's moving in on you. And, yeah, the Arab was a guy that
robbed B&C Meats.
You would never find the Arab. He was a street guy. No telling where he was. But Johnny Brocato had, like, a little business. And he was already a suspect in planting a bomb on their social club also. So somebody had planted a bomb in the back door of their North End, what they called the Northview Social Club.
And he was the electrician?
He was the electrician, yeah.
And they thought maybe it was him that did it.
They thought he probably at least built a bomb. He may not have done it. And you know, Crago, about this time, Crago gets arrested. He's out of control. Spiro can't keep him under control. He never would have been able to. He robs another drug dealer over on the east side, a kind of a big-time drug dealer whose name I cannot remember and have not been able to figure out. But he was a Dilaudid and Percocet and Percodan and those kinds of pharmaceuticals they sold back in the 70s. And he was a reasonable-sized drug dealer, and Crago went over to rob him. And one of his kids slips out and calls the police. The police show up, and they find Crago there, and he has two guns. And I checked into Crago. The first robbery he did where he was in the penitentiary before they got him out, he had two guns. When he robbed Al Brandemeyer, he had two guns. When he robbed this drug dealer, and they sent him back for parole violation on that one, he had two guns. So anyhow, Crago leaves. He goes back. I checked on him later. He was never able to regain his dominance, and he ends up spending his last few years in segregation down there and dies of a heart attack. So that's the
locked
end of,
up.
Locked up. Yeah, on the parole violation because he's going out doing another robbery. So Crigo's gone. Spiro is still...
Did you ever find out, did he go on to run the inside business
He was never able to regain it. He never was. He'd lost it. When he went back, other people had moved in, and he was not able to regain it, and he ended up having to go into solitary confinement for the rest of his time there, and he just dies there shortly thereafter, like in the next couple of years. But that's now this is the scene. I have set the scene for the next show. Carl Spiro's recruited a gang to move in on Savella operations. Nick Savella has given orders to underboss Tuffy DeLuna to take whatever steps necessary to neutralize this Spiro threat And Tuffy is going to strike soon. And in the next exciting episode, I'll tell you the story of the Virginia Tavern ambush. And, you know, Aaron, since we don't have any sponsors yet, we're going to get them. I'm assured of that. We need to advertise ourselves a little bit. So don't forget about the BigDumbFunShow.com, and you can listen to them live on Monday nights and Wednesday nights at Harlan's, or drop by Harlan's between 7 and 9 and see Aaron broadcast live.
6 and 9, actually. In the month of March, though.
Oh, okay.
For every Wednesday. But actually, the more important thing, of course, would be some of the source material, which is your experience and your DVD.
Right, my DVD.
Documentary, and also, Gangland Wire.
I have a blog. I've been blogging for the last couple of years about organized crime and my experiences at my website, www.ganglandwire.com. You also can find my DVD at www.ganglandwire.com.
And if you'd like to have him on as a guest on your show, you're certainly available. You've been on our show a number of times.
I've been on the Big Dumb Fun Show. I do talks at Rotary Clubs, PEO meetings, at libraries. And
you were just in Las Vegas in January for Mob Month.
And for Mob Month, I went out and showed my movie and did a Q&A afterwards, and it was a lot of fun. And they want to have me come back with one of my other movies. I did a movie on the Underground Railroad on the Western Frontier. And one other thing is, on my blog, you also might notice there's a few people from the old days that make cryptic comments on some of my entries, and there's also some mad relatives that you'll make comments every once in a while. So that's kind of an interesting read if you plumb down in and find and see the comments on my blog.
And the last names on them?
One of them, they're not going to be happy with this show. I promise you that. The other one, I can't remember the last name. It wasn't a last name. We're just mad about the whole thing.
But we'll lock the door for the second episode, unless we're going to tape it right now.
And one other thing, if you would like to take a tour of Kansas City mob sites, I created an app called Kansas City Mob Tours. So go to your favorite app store and search for Kansas City Mob Tours, and for $1.99, you too can find all the mob sites in Kansas City.
The Trap?
The Trap, you'll find The Trap, or the Northview Social Club, as they called it. You'll find Nick Savella's house. You'll find Tom Pendergast's house. You'll find where Johnny Lazy is killed. You'll find where Charlie Gagata and Charlie Bonaggio were killed.
Can you actually find the bullet holes on the wall at Union Station?
You can find. I took a picture of the bullet holes on the wall at Union Station and gave you explicit directions. Not only that, there's a map. The app links to Google Maps, and there's a map that'll take you right to these spots. You'll go down and see the River Quay. For those of you who remember the River Quay days and the mob war down there, the Virginia Tavern where the Spiros were shot. Oh, I better not talk about that. That's in the next show.
The next episode.
The next episode.
Gangland Wire, Crime Stories. ¶¶